Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 108 of Speaking of Mysteries. This episode's guest is Suzanne Chazen, whose No Witness But the Moon, the third installment in her Detective Jimmy Vega series, was published last fall. Mysteries give writers a wide range of opportunities. It's a given that they will have to tell a compelling story that engages readers to find out who done it, but they also have the chance to examine some of the more nasty bits of civilization. Ingrid Thoff's Fina Ludlow series doesn't shy away from the repercussions of the sexual abuse of children, and Barry Eisler's kick-ass new protagonist, Livia Lone, casts a gimlet eye on both human trafficking and sexual abuse. Publishing a book that is timely is often serendipitous. Books, especially those that are published through traditional channels that include editing, multiple drafts, printing, bindery, and distribution, have lead times of 2 years or more. Suzanne's book is timely on multiple fronts. It's both a sympathetic look at the aftermath of a police officer mistakenly shooting a man of color, as well as the complex world of Hispanic Americans, both citizens and undocumented. Here's Suzanne Chazen. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and today we have Suzanne Chazen, whose No Witness But the Moon was released in the fall of 2016. Welcome, Suzanne.
Hi, Nancy. Nice to talk to you.
I think your character of Jimmy Vega is really, really fascinating. And when crime fiction works, as it does in No Witness But the Moon, it tells not just an engaging story, but it peels back a part of the veneer of civilization and lets readers glimpse some of the unsavory bits. And I think that novel does this and then some. And I just was wondering, is that one of the things in your head as you sit down to write a novel?
Well, Jimmy Vega is a series. He's a series character now. No Witness But the Moon is the third, actually, in the series. So very much what I start with now is really thinking about the man, who he is, what he faces, and then always trying to give him somewhat of a moral dilemma, something that puts him in a position where he has to make choices, and the choices are not always easy. Because I think one of the things I love about crime fiction is I love sort of the moral component, the notion that bad things happen, we have to decide, do we do something about them? How do we do something about them? Do we do them in a traditional way? Do we take matters into our own hands? So I like all those sort of moral questions that go with crime fiction.
For one thing, I found you live in New York, I live in Southern California, and I found this novel eye-opening, especially for those who think the Hispanic community in the United States is uniform, made up exclusively of the undocumented and the illegal. Some Hispanics, like Jimmy, are of Puerto Rican descent, and since Puerto Rico is part of the United States, they may be considered immigrants, but they're also U.S. citizens. Others in the book are of Mexican heritage, and sometimes they're legal and sometimes they're not, or they're from Guatemala or San Salvador, and so on. I mean, was that part of your thinking with No Witness But the Moon?
Yes, it was. It was because when I started this series, I had actually worked as a volunteer at an outreach center for immigrants in my area. We have in the, this is Westchester County, north of New York City, we have a lot of immigrants and immigrants of all kinds. We have of every nationality, but we definitely have a lot of Latin American immigrants, and some of whom are most likely undocumented, some of whom are definitely undocumented, because I did work with people and discovered their stories and found myself really moved by many of them. So when I started this series, I wanted to take a fictional character who was really wrestling with the divide, who had was a Latino culturally. He had his culture. In this case, he's Puerto Rican. But he's also very much an American. He was born in the Bronx. He was raised here. He's a cop. And so I wanted to have, again, that conflict, that sense that, you know, he has a job to do. He believes in the job he's doing. He believes in being a police officer and doing that job well. At the same time, he also has sympathy for people who, you know, there but for a piece of paper could be his family. So, you know, he does have that sensibility in him, and I really wanted to explore that.
And to a certain extent, there's an element of ambiguity in Jimmy's becoming a cop that you explain in the book. He at heart, he wants to be a musician. Becoming a police officer became sort of one of those choices that people have to make in lives. He was married. He had a child on the way. He had to go in a direction where he would be of help, and I think that was always one of his motivations, but also one where he could make a living. And I personally like that kind of ambiguity. He's not gung-ho.
Yeah, you know, I've met a lot of cops through my years. Also, I'm married to a chief in the FDNY, and I know that a lot of police officers and firemen, while many of them are very gung-ho, this is the only job they ever wanted to do, a lot of them end up doing that job because, yes, they have that desire to help people and to do things, and they also may have had less practical notions in other areas that just didn't work out, or they went to college for something, or they chose to go into something that just didn't work out. And I really like the idea that Jimmy was conflicted, that because he wasn't a gung-ho cop, that definitely colored the way he treats his job. He loves what he does, but he also doesn't think about, you know, a knee-jerk notion that the law is right and always right in all situations. He really feels his heart is as a musician, first and foremost.
The long lead time of writing books, you know, for those who haven't written a book, it's about a 2-year process from the time the idea springs in your head and the fingers hit the keyboard to turning it in and getting it edited and getting it scheduled. So my guess is you started to write this book in 2014, and you were working on No Witness But the Moon, when you were working on No Witness But the Moon. The subject matter of immigrants and police shootings of unarmed men of color wasn't as front and center as it is now. How does that make you feel that this book is so timely?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think I'm like most writers. We write about what we really care about, and the world either decides that it's important to the world or it doesn't, but it doesn't stop being important to you. So, as I said, I had worked for, as a volunteer at a center for several years, dealing with the undocumented. So that was a subject near and dear to my heart, and certainly seeing a kind of stagnation where, opportunities just, you know, weren't changing for people, and people were living under long periods of time, without really being able to realize their full potential. That for me was something I wanted to write about. But then certainly after the Ferguson shooting, I was very obviously shocked and upset about what happened. But I also found myself wondering what it must feel like, since my character is a police officer, to be a police officer and to make a mistake. And the mistake that you make, unlike other areas, you know, if you make a mistake, and plenty of doctors do make mistakes, they make the mistake, people don't talk about it, the malpractice pays up, and that's the end. If you make a mistake as a police officer, in some situations it can haunt you for the rest of your career and affect you on a very personal level. And I felt that since Jimmy was a good man, he was an 18-year veteran of this job, he had never fired a gun on the line of duty, I dared to ask the question, what if he made a mistake? And when I first asked it, I was very scared to ask it because I thought, he's my hero, how can I do this? But the more I thought that when you have a question in literature that you're afraid to ask, then that's definitely the question you have to ask.
I think that what you did in the novel is pretty extraordinary because it's not only a portrait of the challenges faced by immigrants, which you portray very accurately without being maudlin. I mean, they have a package of challenges. But your portrayal of Jimmy and the police, especially as a man who fired his weapon in the line of duty and taken a life mistakenly, as it turns out, is sympathetic, and that's kind of like splitting the baby. I mean, that's you should be very, very proud of that.
I guess it goes back to one of my problems as a crime writer is that I have a very easy time thinking about people who are victimized. I have a very hard time thinking about someone doing something out of evil. And I'm really impressed with crime writers who can write really evil characters. I tend to find myself thinking that everyone had a reason and, you know, the old line, everyone's a hero in their own story. And so what I found was what would happen to me? What would I feel if I was in Jimmy's situation? And I started acquainting acquainting myself with sort of the stages of grief, because it certainly is that. And I found myself realizing that a good man would go through the stages of grief, and not all those stages are pretty. I mean, some of them are angry. And I felt that he had to go through them, and the reader had to see that, because otherwise he's just a cold-hearted person. I mean, and he's not. So he has to suffer, and he does.
He does suffer, and I also like, you see, I'm a person, my particular taste goes towards morally ambivalent characters. Now, Jimmy is not morally ambivalent. Something happens to him that causes him to question. But even your bad guys, your so-called bad guys, are not pure evil. In a way, I think pure evil is easier to write. You just think, you know, what is the worst, what sort of Lord Voldemort-esque character can I put down on the pages? But even, and I don't want to introduce any spoilers, but even the characters that have done things that they shouldn't have done, that have set these terrible things in motion, didn't do it, like you said, everyone's a hero in their own story. They didn't set out to be evil. They may have done evil acts, but it's not black and white. That's what I liked about it. It's not black and white.
Yeah, it's I think it's the way life really is. I mean, we don't have, people are not pure good and they're not pure bad. And sometimes I like more what I call traditional bad notions, selfishness, people being selfish or lustful or maybe somewhat greedy, or making a bad decision and then not owning up to it, which makes the decisions worse. I like those sort of building blocks of badness, where people make a bad choice, and rather than own up to the bad choice, they just keep making more to kind of prove that they weren't so bad to begin with, or get themselves out of something. I just think that's more how human nature works. We get ourselves into a pocket based on the fact that we just didn't own up on the beginning to what we had done, and we just keep trying to make it better, but we make it worse.
So the seven deadly sins are yes, our stairway to evil.
The seven deadly sins. Yes, exactly. But I think that's the point, yeah.
This, as you mentioned, this is the third Jimmy novel, and you know it. And what happens in this story changes Jimmy forever. But the ending of No Witness But the Moon hints that there will be more Jimmy Vega stories, and so I'm wondering if you can tell us what's coming up for his fourth appearance.
The next book coming out will be coming out September 26th. It's called A Place in the Wind. And as you can imagine, when you take a life like this as an officer, in reality or in fiction, this doesn't go away, in a day. And one of the things I feel, and sometimes when you read a book and there's a backstory of someone who feels bad about somebody they killed, sometimes there's no repercussions. But for Jimmy, there are repercussions. You know, he's on modified duty. He is not someone who's beloved right now in the job, because even if he was found justified in what he had done, he still has brought a black mark to the department. So in the fourth book, we find him actually on modified duty. He's sort of on the sidelines. And basically some of the problems really come through Adele, his girlfriend, which we haven't mentioned too much, but she's sort of his counterpoint in all these stories. Adele is very differently wired. She is ahead of, she's an advocate for immigrants. She has her own issues. And in the fourth book, we have a young woman who is a blonde-haired, blue-eyed high school kid who tutors English at a center for immigrants, this center being the one that Adele runs. And she leaves a session one night in the tutoring, and she disappears. And as you can imagine, the longer she's missing and the more tension is stirred up in the town as to what happened to this young woman and whether the immigrants were involved in that. And so Jimmy ends up coming into that. But he himself is kind of on the sidelines right now. He's having a very tough time, and his reputation keeps following him and keeps making matters worse in his life. And he gets some pretty unpleasant assignments during this time, which he, of course, tries to make lemonade from lemons, but not always, doesn't always work so well.
Well, we should talk about Adele, because she is, I believe, Ecuadorian.
Yeah.
And it just further demonstrates that although Spanish is a common language, she and Jimmy, from at least their ethnic heritage, it's about the same as someone from, you know, North Dakota and Scotland.
Right, exactly.
there's not a uniformity by their language. It can be funny among those of Hispanic descent, but maybe, you know, a new world for Anglos, I think.
Well, I think one of the things and one of the reasons I picked Adele is also American-born, but she's the child of undocumented Ecuadorians. And the reason I picked that was because her background is so totally different from Jimmy's. I mean, he grew up with a single mother in the Bronx, Puerto Rican. He was always an American, but he had some definite issues, some problems in his life. He had to overcome a lot, but totally different issues from Adele, who grew up with two parents who lived in fear of a police officer knocking on their door and taking them away, and Adele and her sister, who were American-born, having to grow up worrying about that. So her view of things is very different. Also, her view of police officers as a result is very different. So her dating Jimmy immediately is a big deal for her. I mean, to trust someone who her whole childhood was about avoiding. You don't go, if you have some crime is committed and somebody robs you or hurts you, you don't tell a police officer. A police officer's not your friend, not to a Adele and her family, and that yet here she's dating a man who she loves and trusts, and so I really wanted to explore that. And you know, she's a real high power, high achiever. She's a Harvard graduate and a lawyer, and she's chosen to give all that up to work running this community center. So she's really quite a sort of noble character, a very idealistic person. And Jimmy's much more pragmatic. He's a pragmatic guy. He's not interested in politics. He wants to do the best he can right here, right now. And Adele has larger and loftier thoughts. So I wanted to contrast them on every level.
Well, you touched on why you chose this particular subject as sort of the meat of your series. But let me ask you, what draws a nice woman like you to a life of crime?
Well, let's see. Well, first of all, I guess I should say that, well, I did my first series was actually on the FDNY, the New York City Fire Department. As I mentioned, my husband is a chief in the FDNY. So my first series that I ever wrote was about a female New York City fire marshal who had been a former New York City firefighter. So that's all part of the FDNY. She became an investigator. And so I was sort of, in a sense, I was writing what I know theoretically, but I was writing what I don't know, because I never was a firefighter. And I found arson interesting. I also found it interesting to insinuate myself into situations I'd never experienced. It was thrilling. And obviously, once you get the bug for being somewhere in fantasy that you aren't in reality, it becomes very interesting. So when I decided to do the second series, being a male cop isn't vastly different from being a female firefighter. I wasn't a female firefighter either. So that part was not that difficult for me. And then simply, as I said, the subject matter was something that was interesting to me. I'm also first-generation American, the daughter of immigrants. My father was actually a refugee. So from all those standpoints, you know, I have a real interest in those issues, even though I am not in any way a Latina, and I do not even speak Spanish, unfortunately.
Who influenced you? Which writers did you read? And who influenced you? And they're not always the same writers.
Well, I have to say that I've always loved darker stories, you know, and I always enjoyed. Well, one of my favorites was Dennis Lehane. I mean, I always wanted to write like Dennis Lehane. I thought he was a fabulous writer. I loved everything he did. Growing up, I didn't read as many mysteries. I was more of a person who liked I liked stories by Howard Fast, and I liked a variety of pop fiction. I worked in a drugstore, and I would tend to pick up books off the paperback rack and read them when we had slow periods. And so, I mean, there were writers who wrote under pseudonyms, and I enjoyed them. I enjoyed all that sort of Sidney Sheldon stuff. So I think I was always more in that vein. And then as an adult, I found I really liked memoirs. You know, I really enjoy reading stories about people who have survived the Holocaust, history books, people who have been in, you know, terrible disasters in their lives. So I've read a whole variety variety. And then, of course, now I just enjoy reading books by contemporaries that are like, you know, Hallie Efren, I really enjoy. And I enjoy Lee Child, and he's somebody I know too. And so I'm kind of an eclectic reader. Right now I am reading, actually, I just finished a book. Oh, now this is terrible. I can't think of the name. And as soon as you go, I'll tell you what I am reading. I'm going back and reading a lot of James Lee Burke, which I really enjoy. And I can't think of the book I just finished, which wasn't James Lee Burke. And I'm also going back and reading a lot of William Kent Kruger, who I loved Ordinary Grace, but never had a chance to read his Cork O'Connor series, which I'm really enjoying right now. So I guess I read all around the block, you know, everything.
I think it's wonderful about crime fiction in general that as it expands and includes more writers, it's not perceived as if I read your book, it doesn't mean I won't read Lee Child. It's not a zero sum game. It's just this ever expanding universe, and I think that's fantastic. And I think it's wonderful when new writers come to readers' attention. You know, because you might have a favorite, a James Lee Burke or Michael Connelly or Lee Child. They only come out with books once, maybe twice a year. So what are you going to do in the meantime?
Right.
So then you discover these writers that are just so fantastic and have compelling characters and great stories, like Jimmy Vega. And you become hooked, and it's a little like falling in love without being unfaithful to your spouse.
That's true. And that is true. Like I've been enjoying Julia Dahl's series about her Rebecca Roberts, who is she's wonderful. So I really enjoyed her. And the one I was just thinking of that I just read was, I just finished The Girl Before, because everyone's reading it. So that was the one I couldn't think of. But I often think about writing, reading is like Baskin Robbins. You know, there's rum raisin, there's cherry vanilla, there's mint chocolate chip. Everybody can have something. It doesn't have to be the same. And just because you don't like rum raisin doesn't mean someone else won't like rum raisin. So I think it's good. And I also think that every story expands a viewpoint. I mean, you know, you look at something or see something differently. And that's what I really love. I love books that take me to a place or a person that I would never get to know in real life. You know, that's why I enjoy Julia Dahl's series, because I feel like that really takes me in places I wouldn't go. I don't know the wilds of Minnesota, but I know it through, you know, William Kent Kruger. I mean, I think those things are really, really fun.
We're conducting this interview via Skype, and unfortunately, you can't see me, or it might actually be fortunate because it's still early here. but you mentioned that you do Skype for libraries, and I would assume book clubs. I think that's fantastic. What do you learn from those exchanges? I mean, what surprises you about groups of readers?
Just how different they are. You know, I write a series that you can read it as a straight mystery and say, I didn't guess that was going to be the ending. I didn't guess that was going to be the killer. I didn't see this particular twist coming. You can read them as books where you say, I really didn't know these aspects about the world of the undocumented or what it's like to be a police officer. So what I find is fascinating when you do a book club is you go in cold and you really don't know, even though it's, in most cases, these are mystery book clubs, you really don't know what the readers want to talk about. So I have done book club things, and I always let the readers take the lead. So I've had ones where readers really want to talk about, why do you write this character? How come you're a woman writing a man? Or why did you make that twist in the story? And I've had other ones where they really want to talk about philosophy, about why, you know, certain things going on in the world, how it relates to your books. Sometimes they want to talk about somebody who's interested in publishing themselves and what publishing is about. So I find them interesting because you never really know what people want to say. And, you know, it's a chance for a real nice communion between the writer and between people who are actually interested in reading their books, which is wonderful. It's like showing baby pictures. Everyone wants to show pictures of their own family.
Exactly, because books really are a little like your children. You send them out in the world and you want them to be liked, but you also want to hear if they've misbehaved.
Yes, yes. And you get amazing. I mean, some of the things that have come back from readers are wonderful. You get these wonderful perspectives where two readers will be arguing a point in a story, and you never even thought about it that much. Maybe when I was writing it, I was thinking about maybe more the plot point from that. And you'll have two readers saying, no. When she did that, she did it because of X, Y, and Z. And that made perfect sense because of blank. And the other reader will say, well, I think this or I think that. And you get a whole new viewpoint, which is just fascinating.
Well, I can't wait for the next Jimmy Vega. It's September. We'll be here before we know it, even though it's only February.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on
Thank
the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Nancy. You take care, and I really appreciate you having me on.